So I said the topic was an exploration of inquiry. And inquiry as somehow this dynamic, alive, vital, source of spiritual unfolding. And I thought I'd start by saying why this is my topic, or why I'm so concerned about this. And I guess it's because I'm so concerned about the strength of stuckness in people's lives. And I feel heartbroken at seeing how hard people are trying and how little changes. In the history of psychoanalytic thought, near the end of his career, Freud became so perturbed by how people had this, it was as if they drew certain fates to them that had happened before. The fate neurosis he began talking about, and he called it a repetition compulsion, and he was so much at a loss to explain it to himself, he said there must be a separate instinct, the death instinct, that is fighting with the libido and the life instinct, and is just pulling us and saying, no, don't change. That keeps on wanting to create this, what I said in the beginning, homeostasis, so holding on to the sameness. So then my fascination has been with people who come to me for more mindfulness instruction and spiritual direction. What's holding them in place? So it's a deep concern of which I've felt a lot of pain. I'll just give two quotes from various wisdom traditions, or what I find the most common thing I found, and I've studied many wisdom traditions, is there's two possible explanations I've heard offered for this stuckness. One is that we all suffer from a case of mistaken identity. And so all of our practices are just practices done by this thing which isn't us, is this personality that is actually the vehicle we use to drive around in this plane of existence. And so we just are out there, you know, buffing up the exterior of our paint job of the vehicle, and we have a more spiritualized ego at the end, or maybe a nicer ego, but the bigger change of realizing we are not that at all, and who we actually are, seems to happen, but rarely. So mistaken identity. Nothing need be done, is an old Chan Buddhism saying. Merely cease to cherish your opinions. So the other main explanation that I've heard in many traditions is that we suffer from so much ignorance, and the largest ignorance is what's called learned ignorance, which is consensual reality. In order to have maybe not a sangha, but in order to have a society, you all have an agreed upon reality. Who we take ourselves to be was largely what could be seen by those people around us, so they could mirror it back, they could hold it in us. And all those parts of it that they could not see or hold kind of got left vacant, and we miss them. We ache for those parts that no one could hold for us or see in us. I don't know anybody who's expressed what learned ignorance better than Mark Twain when he said, "It ain't what you don't know that'll get you into trouble. It's what you know for sure. It just ain't true." There's something about what we know for sure is the permanence that locks us in place. There's a lot that I used to think inquiry was, and if you were raised in the same school systems I were, you probably have a lot of the same learned ignorance about what inquiry is. What I thought inquiry was, you know, and I have two master's degrees, and I was a year into a PhD, and there still was one basic trend of what inquiry is, which is to move from an answer, I mean, to move from an answer to a question. But what I was taught was to move from a question and get to the answer, and get to the right answer as efficiently as possible. Because being in the question and not having the answer is an anxious place to be. You don't want to be there. In fact, you want to get to the answer and find you have the right answer, and then something can rest and drop. So working with inquiry as a practice is about learning to be in, as Rilke famously said, love the questions for now. Just love the questions. And what does that mean? It sounds like a poetic thing to say. Well, let me try to put some meat under what that would mean. In order to help give focus to my talk, I love speaking just extemporaneously, but I know I would wander in so many directions. So I wrote an outline to hold myself to a set unfolding. And I also chose one question to pursue. The question might be interesting, it's my question, but what I thought is if I follow out how I opened and worked with one question, you could kind of see what my process was, how, and then you could use that process to work with your own questions. So I will start with Genesis. I will start with two stories about how I came into my question. And the first was in 1974, at the earliest Dharma talk that I still remember, was from Jio Kennett Roshi at Mount Shasta Abbey. And she was saying that this was a Soto Zen tradition, which in contrast with the Rinzai Zen tradition gives a whole formal system of koans, unsolvable riddles, probably of which the most famous is we all know the sound of two hands clapping. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Or my favorite is, what is the face you had before your mother was born? So these riddles are meant to bring the mind to an impasse, to where it cannot keep thinking the way it always has learned to think, to stop it, but neither to go into despair and give up, nor to settle and pretend that there is just a simple answer. It's really a dynamic place to get to. So she said, in Soto Zen, we do not give formal koans. She said, if you just pay attention to your life, you will realize there is an unsolvable riddle. And if you would face the unsolvable riddles of your life, you have your koan. She said, Zen without koans is quietism. And I felt this pang of guilt, because what I had liked about the Zen practice I'd begun about a year before was, it was giving me some quiet. But I thought, well, I can trust this quiet it's giving me, but she's giving me something else. She's challenging that. What is this quietism that she's talking about? Okay, so maybe 10, 20, I don't know how many years later, a story from the Vipassana, from the tradition that this group is meeting in, came from Sharon Salzberg and one of her teachers in India, a Bengali man named Munindra, and he taught Joseph Goldstein and Sharon. And he put this question to Sharon. He said, Sharon, the Buddha's enlightenment is the solution to the Buddha's problem. What problem are you trying to solve? Well, that spun my cap around. I had thought I knew the whole thing, which was, you know, when you have a teacher, you try to figure out what the teacher likes, and you're impressed by the teacher. And if I was a student of the Buddha, I would try to come up with the same answers and the same questions, of course. Why is there suffering and clinging and aversion? And, you know, I had learned all my, you know, the five this and the eight that's. To say, wait a minute, maybe what it means to follow the Buddha is not to take up the Buddha's question. And then when I began really thinking about it, I thought, I was not raised in a pleasure palace where I never knew suffering, old age, disease, and death. And kind of, if anything, I was raised kind of in the opposite, where all I knew was struggle and suffering and difficulties. I would have a completely different path. I was needing to find out where equanimity and is there even a possibility of that in this lifetime, in this being that I am? So it really made me take my path to be very serious that I really needed to find out what question I was pursuing. So the question that I propose to work with, besides meditation, what else can I do? And one of the first things I do when working with a question is to ask myself, so who in me is the one who has that question? Who am I taking myself to be when this question has captured me? What do I know about this part of me? Well, the usual answers come from the usual form of knowledge, and the usual, what we ordinarily think of as knowledge, is actually all knowledge from the past. Everything we call knowledge is something that was true at one time to somebody, and they passed it on to us, or maybe we had a moment when we just clearly knew something, we saw something, and those are wonderful moments when we just saw, oh my gosh, look at the person I'm drawn to dating. Oh, look at this. And we have this clear seeing. But even that knowledge, tomorrow, is just ordinary knowledge. It's knowledge that was once true, and we don't know if it's still going to be true for this next brand new moment. So, besides what I might say, so let's say you say, oh, I see, this is the child part of me. This is a very young part of me that has this question. Or this is the part that was always trying to make dad think. Or this is that part who was, so we have our history. We know our sub-personalities. We may know that. But how do you go about when you realize that's not the whole story? I've already told myself that. There's this wonderful moment in doing solo individual psychotherapy when I realize a person has come to the end of telling me answers they've already thought of before, all their ordinary knowledge about themselves. And we slow down enough, and we start paying attention particularly to felt senses in the body, and we pause a lot, and we hang out in not knowing a while. And the person starts saying, yeah, I'm just always, I trust people right away, and then something happens, and immediately I just feel like I was I've always been that way. I mean, but it's not that I don't trust. What is it? It's, I lose track of myself. That's what it is. I realize they're finding out, they see something, and they're correcting what they said. And I thought, how are they correcting what they just said? And I see that what's going on is they're checking what they're saying against something that their body holds, and something in there is saying, no, that's not the whole story. There's something more there. Yeah, that's partially true, but maybe it's not the whole thing. And that's very exciting. There's a listening. There's a real freshness in what they're going to discover. So, a great person who has studied this is Eugene Genlin, and he came up big in the 80s, was a sort of work that first got started, which was called focusing. And focusing is all about learning to listen to the felt senses you have and learning to dialogue with them. So, when this question of asking, so what is this? Who is this in me who has this question? When I would ask it, what I could see is whoever had the question had something desperate about him. When I sent David the title for the talk, I remember I used all the typographical stuff I could use. I put bold and a question mark and an exclamation point. Besides meditation, what else can I do? And it's that quality of... And I thought, who is this? Well, he's someone who's trying to show me that he's trying. He really is trying to meditate. He's trying to be a good Buddhist. And I could feel in my body when I had this question, there was something sort of contracted around the question. I felt it was almost, I wasn't sure I was allowed to have this question. Like maybe it was vaguely blasphemous that I was asking this question. Why was that? So another way to put the question is, what is the questioner's relation to the question? What's at stake for me Why is this question challenging? Most of the questions that revolve and revolve and revolve and we can't find answers to, it's because who has them is a part of us that we somehow disown. We really have a difficult time claiming that part. So a lot of the roots of the question are not visible. We can't see why the question's there because they're hidden from us. We just see the thing that grew up above the ground. There's the question. But we can't see other parts that are feeding the question. So I realized that I felt almost like something shameful there was in me admitting that I had this question. And when I really thought, who are you who has this question? Let me point out something. One of the first things I find that's helpful when I work with a question is to drop speaking in first person. To not say, I just can't figure out why I can't, and I do this, and yet I keep thinking, I find I get really caught. But when I switch to say, oh, the one who has this question, he sounds pretty desperate to me. And when I let myself feel him even more, and when I give him a couple of deep breaths, and I don't rush him, and I say what I feel going on, I say, feels like you're pretty desperate. And now I'm using you. But I'm using either second person or third person in trying to get into relationship to a part that has somehow become estranged from me. And I need to enter into relationship with this part. I heard on the Boulder station one time I was driving, they had Jane Goodall, the woman who worked amazing work with the chimp. And I remember she was saying how she'd gotten her grant and she'd done all the study of chimps and she'd got to the location where she was going to study. And every day where she'd go where there was a lot of chimps, they just ran away from her. And like, 2 weeks, 3 weeks going by, and they didn't trust her. And the first thing she realized was she changed clothes all the time, and to them she was a brand new ape because she was wearing totally different clothes, and so she realized she'd have to wear the same clothes over and over and not wash in between until she'd smell exactly like herself. And then she realized she probably needed to get occupied and do something herself. And she noticed they would do different things, so she would start taking a stick and stick it in an anthill, and you know, she'd kind of act like they were. That is kind of like the way you have to court a part of you that is a question, which is you have to let it know you're not very aggressive and that you're going to hang out and you're not impatient. Most of us, when we have a question, we are so impatient with it. Just tell me what I need to do. I'm sick of this in myself, this obsession, this anxiety, this depression, why do I keep doing it? Just get it out, you know, give me an appendectomy, cut that part of me out. And, you know, and I feel like, wow, there is a long battle going on between this person and that part, and we need to find a relationship with that part. We need to enter into a dialogue with it. So, there's a great thing that comes out of narrative therapy, and they say, the person is never the problem. The problem is always the problem. So, have externalizing conversations so you and your patient, you and your client, can both talk equally and be curious about the problem. But the problem is not in them. It's a problem that they're dealing with. So I began doing that with my own question. And I began thinking, who else would have this question? And the grace of the universe put me down the right supermarket aisle where the right Shambhala magazine was on the cover, and I saw Reggie Ray had a column which was, is meditation enough? And something leaped for joy inside of me. And it was then that I realized that his asking that question was going to let me have my question. That I felt like if I only were doing meditation the right way, I wouldn't be having this question. It was like those kids who never bring up their question in class because they just assume they must be dumb. Everybody else is getting it. And so they're quiet. And the teachers go crazy thinking, how can I get them to ask the actual questions and let me know where they're confused? Otherwise, I can't help them. That's a, you know, great question that teachers deal with. So I felt this relief. I felt what in focusing work they call a felt shift. I mean, I could actually feel my body. Relax. Open up. There was more room. The question could extend and live in my body largely because it was okay. If Reggie Ray, this famous meditation teacher, if he was asking, is meditation enough? And then I read enough of it to see he was saying, no, maybe it isn't. I've done 30 years of meditation and I found that the way we meditate is not enough. I was thinking, hallelujah. And that just was such a learning because I thought, I've been stuck in my question because I've been ashamed that I had the question. I have not been available to learn anything from the question. So when you move your question out of the domain of moral judgment, you know, am I a bad Buddhist or not, that allows curiosity. And to curiosity, I would add two more C's just to make a nice mnemonic for you to remember. Curiosity, of course, has to be coupled with profound, profound compassion. But compassion, I have found, is not enough. There needs to also be a very powerful and a very strong sense of courage. Because to ask the questions that are off limits, we are risking shame. And shame is the emotion that's closest to physical pain in our sensorium, how we feel. It most feels like, as what is it? Brené Brown says, shame is the experience that you are not worthy of love and belonging. You are cast out. And that's what I was risking, was being cast out for even having my question. So then that gave me a new question. Is meditation enough? Okay, well, that's curious. Enough for what? Enough? Well, to be enlightened. Well, of course, none of us are going to get enlightened. It's just, you know, it's the... You know, we're in the wrong country and we don't do things right. We don't sit on mats or anything. You know, there's this whole thing, well, what is it that would be enough? To escape suffering? Yeah. Yeah, I sure would like to suffer a lot less. A lot. That would be one. And that's what I thought I was getting into. And then as I got closer to this one who had the question, I realized how let down and heartbroken and disappointed of the promise I had felt from meditation, when I started it. I'm jumping ahead in my talk, but my experience of meditation and how the relationship people have with it is very, very much like a romantic relationship. And it almost always begins with a honeymoon period, where when you first start meditating, there's this like, oh my gosh, the mind likes to be watched. I had my first child when I was 45 years old. So I became a father late in life. And so it was a wonder what I could learn about myself from my child. And when she was barely 3 years old, I remember one day she said to me, she said, Papa, who's keeping an eye on me today? And I thought, that's the language my wife and I use. So will you keep an eye on Molly? I've got to do this. Okay. And she picked up that language, and I began thinking of D.W. Winnicott in his whole sense that a child cannot enter into play, into this amazing state that he called neither integration nor disintegration. But he said there's some other state that a child goes into when it's capable of playing. And he called it unintegration. I mean, he had to make up a new word because no one had named this in-between state. And he said a child can do that only if it's left alone and its solitude is looked over, knowing someone is there to kind of keep an eye on them. They can let go of holding themselves together. They are not holding, they can let go and they can open up. And they're, there's a big theorist in Gifted and Talented, Polish researcher whose name doesn't come to me right now, but he talks about creative disintegration. That was the closest he could come to. So anyway, there's this valuable state, which is who's keeping an eye on me? And my sense of what happens when people start to meditate is all of a sudden, someone non-judgmentally is keeping an eye on their mind and their whole process, their feelings, and watching them. And there's something that's like, oh, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. And the mind does begin getting quieter, knowing it's watching. And then you might notice, as you start noticing very carefully, wait a minute. For hundreds of thousands of years, I've been thinking about my thinking and trying to improve my thinking by thinking about it. But this is not that. I'm doing something different. I'm not thinking about my thinking. Something is watching my thinking, but it's not thinking. Wait a minute, who am I? I thought I was that thinking. I thought that voiceover soundtrack, the narrator of the whole show, I thought that was me. Well, then who's watching? Who's watching me? Who's watching the guy who does the soundtrack? Because, you know, it's this mission. And what you're entering into probably the deepest root question, which is that question of, who am I? What am I really? And a third question, which is just as important, which is, what is this? The self is not the mystery, or it's not the only mystery. George Opin has a line in his poem, the self is not the mystery, the mystery is that there is something for us to stand on. That there is something rather than nothing. That's a mystery that we always have to pretend is not there. To get about our business, to do our projects, we have to pretend that of course we know why there's something here rather than nothing. Of course there's just earth, you know. So what I call that process is a process of disidentification, which is not at all disowning. You're noticing, oh my gosh, all of this that's gone on in me keeps going on with me. I'll call it your conditioned self or your reactive self. And there's someone who's not part of that, who's holding it. Which is the space where it all goes on in. Tatwamasi, you are that, they say in Vedanta. You are that, which is watching it all. So this is that root question of, who am I really? So let me come back to the question. Besides meditation, what else can I do? What I could see was the biggest part of the question was doing. And I realized that was so central to why I pursued. I was raised Roman Catholic, but I raced out of Roman Catholicism. I mean, first I went to Unitarian Church, you know, and that was kind of a way of just breaking out. And then I, like 17 or 18, I would read books about, and I went, oh my gosh, there's something I can do. And it was not just something, there was something I can do about this madness, this craziness, this unhappiness that I could see I was. But I didn't need anybody even. I mean, I really ignored the Sangha part. Yeah, I'll just do two out of the three. You know, Buddha, Dharma, that's enough. I'll just start with that. I'll do the Sangha later. And what I found was a lot of the, what I call us ABCs, American Buddhist converts, a lot of us ABCs were refugees from faith. I remember teaching a man who was at the verge of suicide and teaching him just some really basic body scans and mindfulness-based stress reduction. And he told me, it is such a relief for me to know that I don't have to wait on grace. And I could see he was relieved, and yet it was one of the most poignant things I've ever heard anyone say. Been raised very evangelical Christian, and his hurt at losing his faith as a child, his wounding from feeling that it had all been a bunch of lies, a bunch of hooey, who could trust all that? And so we get drawn to Buddhism without beliefs. Buddhism without relationships is what I think it is. For me, it most certainly was. I didn't trust anybody. I could do this my damn self. And I use the word damn not just as a cuss word. My damn self. Very isolated place to do meditation practice from. But that's what sold me on it. I don't need to depend on anyone. I don't need to be in relationship. And so many people either come to my therapy practice or start coming and asking me for direction in their spiritual practice because they just divorced or they just had another relationship end. And they're sort of like, screw them. I can't trust relationships. Teach me how to meditate. And I, you know, have to slowly break the news to them. Meditation is about relationships. Only with a person you can't get away from. You can disown, you can dissociate, you can do all you want. And that's all good. Those are timing devices. They are your defenses and they're there to keep things at bay until we're ready to slowly peel them off. And gradually, there's a beautiful, beautiful timing in the universe that we get ready to drop and trust gets built between us, and gradually the pain that, with the pain that we store, we also have memorized some very outdated messages. The biggest outdated message is, if you felt this, it would kill you. I remember I told my first therapist, if I started crying, I would never stop. So don't you get me started. Just feeling it. Nope, nope, this is not. And that's, into a very young nervous system, it actually was true. We would fry. We couldn't handle feeling, that much feeling. And so it got stuffed into our body. The body is the unconscious mind. That's why all the knowledge we need is in the body. Okay. The backlash, the bad side of this bootstrapping, rugged individualism approach to Buddhism is that when the honeymoon period's over, and there's either what the Desert Fathers used to call acide, these dry spells when just nothing, it just feels dead, it just feels boring and stupid, or there's actually, so some of the ways you teach Vipassana, I don't know if you use this language here, but is as part of a two-phase thing, shamatha, vipassana. And shamatha would be calm abiding, and then that leads to and develops vipassana, which is clear seeing. To me, when I look at my 40-some-odd years of meditation, it felt like the first 20 years or something was looking at myself as if it were an ocean liner out there, and I just could see everything above the waterline. And I would do paint jobs above the waterlines and decorate the chairs and arrange nice music and do Buddhist things up on the boat. But where my practice really got serious was when there was enough vipassana, enough clear seeing, that it was as if that boat got pulled into what they call a dry dock. And they will drain all the water from it. And you see what's below the waterline. And you see the gashes. And you see all the non-Buddhist parts of yourself. All the parts you've disowned and you sure do not belong. And that's what became more and more my practice was, holy Lord, I swore I wouldn't be like my dad. And yet look at this. I'm just, oh my gosh, how could it? And all this clear seeing was seeing stuff that turned my stomach. And so the later phases of meditation, you need other skills. And to me, the biggest skill I needed was I needed to do a lot of learning about the superego. And I could spend a whole Dharma talk talking about that. But let me just, I'm going to try to keep this really short part because I want to get to some other things. So in the tripartite map of the self that Freud first built up, there was, it's consistent. I could tell you the word in Jewish mysticism. They speak of the commanding self, and the commanding self is very much the ego. It's that which I want what I want, and I'm going to try to get what I want. I'm going to try to what Buddhism calls the eight worldly wins. I'm trying to have less pain and more pleasure. I'm trying to win more. I'm trying to lose less. That's just runs that part. That's who we think we are. But there's two other parts. There's what the Sufis call the animal soul, what Freud called the id, which just means it. It means it's kind of a pre-personal. Sufis say we're all born with an animal soul. We almost all get socialized and we have a human soul. We actually lose a lot of our juiciness in becoming a human soul. Some parts of us that keep erupting out were things because we were closer to true nature back in our animal soul. And then the Sufis say we can work towards having a angelic soul or divine soul. But let's just come back to the superego. So the superego, the German word for it was the Über-Ich, which means it's above the eye. And I always picture those 1940s prison movies where the guards would walk around those prison things around the outside and they're slapping their billy club, you know, and they look at me. And that's what your superego is. It's walking, it's always watching over you. It's your inner judge. It's always commenting. And I used to think that was the most trustworthy part of it. It was what held, it also, Freud came up with a different name, and now they're differentiated in psychotherapy understanding, which is the ego ideal, which is I deserve to be loved the most I conform to my ego ideal. And one of my teachers once told me about the ego ideal. He said, the ego ideal is the donkey that you will ride all the way to full self-realization. It is that which glimpses what is good as best as you can see it. And it will see as much as it can see, but it's still what John of the Cross called the dark night of the soul. It was when finally the last ego ideal drops away and there is just nothing. And there's the night of the senses and there's the night of the spirit. And then who one really is fully awakens. But most of us aren't there yet. Let me just go back to... No, let me just be quiet for a minute. Yeah, let me just tell you a tiny story out of my own life and working with some of my own madness and my craziness. During the summer times, we cook this dish with pesto and green beans and pasta and potatoes and different things, all sorts of things you can put pesto on. And when it came time to cutting the green beans, I'd often notice that if I weren't cooking alone and my wife were cooking with me, I would try to very carefully make sure she didn't notice that I was going to cut the green beans because she didn't cut them right. She cut them quickly. She just put them and she'd whack off more than a quarter of an inch of wasted green bean would be there. And I would just one at a time kind of nip off about 1/32nd of a green bean end so it wouldn't be wasted. And that is so, you know, even I thought to share this little story with you, I thought, well, that is the most trivial and stupid thing I could think of to share with everyone. And when I even thought of noticing that this was bothering me, my mind said, no, don't, there's nothing to notice there. Nothing to notice there. Come on, keep driving, everyone. I'm just going past. There's nothing to notice. Nothing. Pay no attention to that. Well, if there's one thing I learned from many years of meditation was when I'm trying not to notice something, wake up. When I'm trying to do something behind my own back, maybe I could find enough compassion and courage to say, what the hell? Why not find out what's real? Mindfulness is achieved when reality takes precedence over the ego. In couples therapy, I see this happen, and it's a wonderful moment. Couples come in usually 5 years after they should have come into couples therapy, and there's so much burnt ground between them, and there's so much pain. I have to practice so hard after a couples therapy session because there's so much pain. And yet, there's this tremendous moment when they've dropped the game of who really is to blame, and they both start thinking, maybe this person I'm married to or, you know, live with, maybe there's something about what is in their experience that would change what I know I might learn something from them. Maybe I should figure out what's really going on. And that I can feel it. I feel the shift. And I see they're caring to know what reality is, even if it doesn't look good for them. And when they both start doing it, we're halfway home. We've turned a corner, and they start seeing that there's a system that's running them, and all these unconscious little cues they're taking and misunderstanding and mistranslating from each other is running them, and they're both being wounded by it. And then they both can see that it is the pattern outside them. And if they could find out about it, they could get free of that pattern. Oh, it's a lovely moment. So chopping green beans and starting to go, well, what is here for me to learn about this? And of course, there's two ways that we normally, you know, that are very good. One is to come up with what we think of as understanding, which is really analytical, using the rational mind understanding. And I could tell you, you know, volumes. My dad grew up in the Depression. I was one of eight children. He had the starvation fear that was just like in his body. He would walk around and make sure we didn't ask for seconds or a larger piece of anything. He would have a big scoop of potatoes and slap it on your plate and fill up with potatoes. And so all of this stuff I could say, see, I understand this already. I have stuff. I grew up in a depression, you know, natural reenactment historical museum. And so, you know, of course I would have this. Ha, 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 ha. And, you know, oh, well, that's just monkey mind. Ha, 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 ha. I found it was really dangerous for me to be superior to the parts of me that were suffering. In fact, I had to stop using the term monkey mind. Because every time I did, it made me believe I was better than the monkey who was suffering with that mind. And that monkey was not going to confide in me as to what was really, what he really believed and why he was really caught. If I wanted to be friends with that monkey, I needed to treat us as peers, as equal. I needed to say, I need to learn from you. You need to teach me. I needed to humble myself to the craziest parts of myself. So clear seeing needs to be balanced by work learning about and finding out how to disengage from this judge superego. And if you wanted a single book to look at, Byron Brown's book, Soul Without Shame, is a tremendous book about really what it takes to break free from this part of us who just exists to keep us from expanding beyond who we are, to keep us being the personality we've been. A tremendous book. So, let me move to another thing. I don't know, I've got to end real quickly. So, another piece of applied mindfulness that's been very helpful for me is something called MBCT for depression, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy for depression. And in that model, they say depression keeps recreating itself until we realize that the default mode of mind is a doing mode of mind or a drivenness mode of mind. And there is another mode of mind. Cynthia Bourgeau says, our computers come with an operating system already inside. You don't have to pay extra for it. It's the operating system that comes with your computer. That's the doing drivenness mode of mind. Every moment we're scanning reality, both externally and internally, and saying, what's wrong with this picture? What discrepancy is there between how things ought to be and how things are? And how you get yourself to act on it is you release adrenaline and cortisol and you feel anxious. I gotta do what? I just can't sit here with it. She's saying those things. I didn't want her to say those things. I mean, and we wanna change something. And it's when it's internal cueing that starts being like depression, and we think, I've got to stop thinking that way, and I can't control, and yet I can't, why? I've got to stop myself, and yet I can't stop myself. There's this circle that starts spinning around. We're caught in this doing-drivenness mode of mind. The other mode of mind, the being mode of mind, we don't have much time to go into, but one of my favorite felt senses of when I learned to switch gears, I've always driven a stick shift, and it feels like stepping on the clutch. And I don't stop anything in my, I don't interfere, but I just disengage. The car's still going, the motor's still going, but they somehow, that need to fix things, just get separated. There's a space there in between the parts. I used to tell myself at times, when I was going through some of my most difficult work, I would remember that song, "Stop in the Name of Love." And I would just tell myself, "For God's sake, please, Christopher, stop. Just stop. Just pause for a minute. Take a breath." Sylvia Boorstein, God bless Sylvia Boorstein. She has this most beautiful, tremendous, she doesn't use any of the language I'm using of being and doing, but she says after 30 years of meditation, what she learned to do was one thing, that she has a good heart. And when she's going crazy in herself, she talks to herself this way. She says, "Sweetheart, relax." And she says the power of that is shocking, is the shock value. What? I am talking to myself using the term sweetheart? That is so shocking. And then what I'm saying to myself is, relax? Are you crazy? I can't relax. The world's going to hell. "Sweetheart, relax," she says. "Take a breath." No, "Sweetheart, relax." Very important piece. "You're in pain." Boy, that changes everything. You're not stupid. And you're not trivial. One thing is, when I realized, when I even thought of this whole thing, I thought, what were the two things my father most insulted us with as children? That we were stupid idiots and that we fought about trivial things. Wow. Isn't it a coincidence that the things, when I want to tell myself, don't notice this, I say, well, that's trivial and that's stupid. Is that really me? Or is that still a relationship I'm having with this man who's been dead for 20 years? Wow. He's still living there. I can see that's not me. I start getting freedom from it. I start saying, shut up. Get the hell out of my head. I want to know these parts of myself that you've been calling stupid and trivial. They are my lost pieces of my soul. I need to find out what they need. I need to enter relationship with them. So, what can you do besides meditation? You can see that meditation is not really doing. Yes, you sit on the cushion and the doing-drivenness part of it says, well, I did my meditation today, now what can I do? And it does, that part is always going to be going on. But there's another part that says, who you are, your being, can pay attention to your life on purpose, non-judgmentally, in the moment, and with profound curiosity. I wonder what this is. I wonder who I really am. Maybe I don't know the answer already. And you can actually relax a little bit and say, I can trust entering this cloud of unknowing. And I can ask questions and make friends with those parts that are so confused within me. So be curious about what your Genjo koan is, what the dilemma is of your everyday life. When something comes up, ask, I wonder who this is in me. I wonder how I could get into a dialogue with that part. I wonder how I could grow my knowledge with all the other parts so we all wake up together. You got to bring everybody with you. They're all going to be included when you wake up. Thank you. Let me turn it back to David so he can give a... Okay.